Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Anne Saxelby, and today's episode is a bit of a technological marvel for us and for the Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from Twig Farm, a diminutive but delicious goat dairy in Cornwall, Vermont. And we're thrilled to be here today with Michael Lee, who is owner, goat herd, shepherd, and cheesemaker here at Twig Farm. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and thanks for having me over for lunch. That was a most delicious lunch.
Pleasure.
We had cheese sandwiches, just so all the listeners know, and also some pickles and other things, but it was a pretty cheese-centric lunch. Yeah. So Twig Farm is, I know that, you know, I shouldn't play favorites when it comes to the cheesemakers that I work with, but I do have to say that I love Twig Farm and the cheeses that Michael makes just about more than any other cheese out there. They make an incredible different array of raw goat's milk cheeses here at the farm. So to start with, we're going to talk about a bunch of different stuff, but to start with, I wanted to talk to Michael about the Champlain Valley and about where the farm is actually located, because it's a very, very beautiful part of Vermont, and it has a lot of dairy history, I think. Is that correct?
I mean, it's, as far as commercial dairying, it kind of follows a lot of the history of the rest of the state, where there was a lot of home dairying, and then in the 19th century, with the expansion of the railroads, there became a lot more commercial as far as producing cream for creameries, and then eventually milk for the Boston and New York markets. But it's been going for a while, and it's in a tough spot right now. But it's been going for a while.
Yeah. So we're in Addison County, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And Addison County, it was a big cow dairy county, to have goats is kind of a different thing for this part of the woods. How do your cow dairy neighbors feel about you guys milking goats?
My next door neighbor, who milks about 200 brown Swiss, thinks it's great. He thinks it's quite a hoot. He always says, "Oh, I used to work with sheep, and they'd always get out, but I never see your goats out, so you must be doing something right." There are some people that are, you know, they take it in stride, and other people are kind of like, "Well, it's not really having a farm, you know," which is fine, you know. That's fine, whatever.
That seems like an interesting thing, because there's definitely sort of an old-school, old-timer way of thinking about dairying, and then, making farmstead cheese like what you do and what, you know, more and more people in the area are starting to do is kind of a new way to think about dairying. And it'll be interesting to see, I think, if it seems like a trend that's continuing to grow. I mean, the farmstead cheese thing and beginning to think about other ways of dairying as the conventional or commercial dairies have sort of faced economic problems in the last, however many years. I don't know how long it's been going on.
Well, it's kind of been going on since the early 80s, but it's gotten a lot worse lately. It is something for a lot of folks to look at, but it's really hard for a lot of people to understand the change that they need to make. A lot of people, their experience of cheese goes no further than what they see at the Hannafords or something like that, and not even most of that. They just look at the the cheddar or the American and or Swiss or and that's what cheese is. And so getting them to think along the lines of what they could make with their raw materials that would make it worthwhile for them to do it it's not a natural sort of progression in a lot of ways. I think they know a lot about milk and they know a lot about making milk, but they don't have an understanding of what cheese can be, I guess.
Sure. But yeah, as I said, it seems like this region in particular is home to so many little burgeoning farmstead cheese producers. It's almost the identity of the Champlain Valley seems to be there definitely is a lot of local food here and an emphasis on local food, but especially the cheeses. So maybe as these kinds of cheeses continue to be made, that'll kind of expand everyone's collective knowledge of what kind of cheese is out there beyond cheddars and beyond Colby's and things like that.
Yeah, I mean that's a hopeful thing to think of it that way. And I think with each passing year that a place like, for instance, like us or any of the other local cheesemakers stays around, the more likely people are to look at it because. The first, it's very, especially the farmers are very conservative, it's like, oh, what's this latest fad, this latest trend, and they're not going to sink a couple hundred thousand dollars into something that's, just going to last for 3 years. Well, they might, but it wouldn't
help them in the long run.
Right. There have been people like Lord Weaver's been at it for 20 years or what have you, and they're still doing it and still doing really well, and there are a lot right here, half a dozen or so within 10 miles of our place.
Yeah.
So,
and it seems like, as these, as more people kind of get into the game, be it cheese making or producing other kinds of sort of artisan foods here in the area, that there is a local market that's pretty nearby and pretty educated and pretty interested in buying these products and finding ways to get them into people's mouths, be it restaurateurs or chefs or farmers markets, which is pretty unique. I feel like a lot of other farms don't have access to that kind of a market.
Yeah, it's tremendous, really, because I think there's somewhere along the lines of 30,000 people in Addison County,
wow.
Which, it's like a block in Manhattan. And, I mean, seriously, there are definitely blocks that have that many people living on them. And if you think about the amount of food that's produced here and consumed here, it's amazing. I can't fathom any place else that's like that.
Yeah. No, I've noticed that there are some. What other networks, I guess, are there for sort of distributions of these kinds of foods besides, the farmers market or, a few local restaurants? Are there other groups that exist that can help, sort of
locally?
Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's the whole Localvore Acorn movement, and so what that does is sort of, these people get together on a regular basis and they trade sort of tips on where they get stuff, and they all do, these big dinners especially during the fall and winter, where they get together at a church hall and everybody brings some locally produced foods And so it's kind of a big sharing of food and also of information where you can get the food. And then there's, I mean, there are a lot of CSAs in the area, and the farmers markets are, they're really a big distribution network. I mean, the Middlebury Farmers Market, which is the largest in the county, has grown. It's probably about twice as big as it was 3 years ago.
Wow.
And, I mean, that's reflected in our sales there. And we're definitely selling about twice as much cheese every week as we did 2 years ago.
That's impressive.
Yeah. And it's, for the size of the town that we're in, you know, we sell 30 pounds of cheese every week there, plus what we sell at the co-op and at the into local restaurant. So
that's great. And it's a short market. It's just a couple hours.
Yeah, 3 hours.
3 hours on a Saturday morning. That's a good, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
That's really great. So I feel like, I don't know, that as more people, I don't know, that's, it's definitely, I feel like, a hopeful thing to see models like this community around Middlebury for what can happen if, or how many farms a small community can support if people are kind of tapped into it and that are buying local.
I mean, it's, when you see it, you know, for a place like this, and you know, granted, I think anybody that produces anything in quantity is selling a large percentage of it outside of our local area. But even so, you know, if only, you know, if, like, let's say in New York, you know, like, if 10% of the people there, you know, purchased the same percentage of locally grown foods as the people around here do, there would be so many small, you know, so many farms right within, you know, the farm shed of New York City that it would be amazing. You know, it just, it's huge, you know.
Absolutely. Get the working landscape kind of, you know, up and working again.
Yeah, you would have to.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's about time for us to take our first break, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more with Michael about how he got started as a cheesemaker and learn a little bit more about Twig Farm. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute. All right, we are back on Cutting the Curd. My name is Ann Saxelby. I'm here today with Michael Lee. We're on the Heritage Radio Network, and our sponsor today is TechServe, the Apple store in Manhattan. And I hear we have a caller on the line who has a question about something cheese-related, maybe. Hello? Is the caller here?
Hello?
Hello?
Hi. I was just wondering if Vermont had any nationally known cheeses that were shipped to all 50 states.
That are shipped to all 50 states. The question was, if Vermont has any nationally distributed cheeses that are shipped to all 50 states. I think the answer to that question is yes. Vermont seems pretty unique in that, you know, it has a large sort of spectrum of cheesemakers. Someone like Michael, who only has 30 goats, might not be able to ship cheese to each and every state. So his cheese does make appearances on cheese counters as far away as California. But there are other cheesemakers here. Jasper Hill Farm is one that you might be able to find in a lot of states around the country. And then there are people who are quite large, such as Cabot Cooperative or Grafton Cheese, and those are co-ops that support large networks of family farms, and those cheeses are more widely distributed. So I would say, I don't know, if you're looking for Vermont cheese, you know, in somewhere that's not quite, or and you're not right in the Northeast or right in the area, it would probably be good just to go to whatever your equivalent would be of a specialty cheese shop and see what they might be able to offer you. I hope that answers the question a little bit. Distribution is definitely one of the toughest things, especially if we're talking about farmstead cheeses. So that's a very interesting question. And I don't know, something that, you know, sort of another question, which is, you know, the cheeses like this that are being made on a small scale, enjoyed locally, they're being made in a limited quantity, and it's kind of like there's only so much that can go around, which is kind of a bummer if the cheese is really tasty, but just kind of the nature of the beast. Michael, do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised. One, I'm surprised at how far afield our cheese gets, because we sort of hand off distribution outside of New England to the Stellars of Jasper Hill, which is Jasper Hill Farms' distribution and aging branch, or however you want to think about it. And we sell them cheese, and then they in turn sell it outside of New England for us. And I think some even within New England, but mostly outside. And it ends up in the darndest places. You know, my sister-in-law lives in Utah, and she finds it there. And I had some friends of the family that were in Missouri somewhere, and they found it there. And it found its way down to, you know, to Dallas, Texas. And, you know, I think it gets around a lot more than I do, that's for sure. So anywhere on a lot of places on the West Coast, and then some big cities in the middle of the country, too.
At least somebody's getting out and seeing the country.
That's right.
You know? If only they could report back.
Right. Yeah, that's funny. Well, sometimes, we get emails or phone calls from friends who have been, you know, traveling, and they go to some fancy restaurant. They say, oh, we had your cheese there. And it's like, oh, you did? I've never eaten there. I wonder how it was.
You got to start keeping a list, so, you know, then when you do take trips, you just know the spots to
right.
hit, you know? You're like, you know that cheese? I made that cheese.
Yeah.
I definitely want to talk about your farm in particular, but as long as we started talking about Jasper Hill and the sellers at Jasper Hill, I did want to just ask you a quick question about that. The sellers at Jasper Hill, so far as I understand, were designed to be a place where the folks at Jasper Hill would buy cheese from small farms all across the state, bring it there to be aged, and then act as a central distribution point, which is, from my end of things, from the cheese retailer's end of things, kind of a blessing, because it means that there's one shipment of cheese coming down to my store every other week on a refrigerated truck, as opposed to a million boxes showing up on my doorstep from FedEx that have been beaten and battered and, you know, abused in every possible way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of an important, it's an important thing that is sort of piece of the puzzle that's being addressed by Jasper Hill in terms of scale and getting these cheeses out there. But for you, it's also got to be kind of hard to relinquish control of something that, you know, you've put so much effort into making from the raising of the goats onward. How do you feel about that?
I'm ambivalent, but practical, you know, in the way that I was just describing how our cheese gets out there. I wouldn't want to be the person putting it out there to all those places. We sell to probably less than a dozen accounts on a regular basis.
Okay.
And I do, I'd say probably about 80% of the work on the farm as far as making the cheese, taking care of the goats, and aging the cheese myself. So that, you know, having a limited number of accounts that I'm shipping to makes it a lot easier. And so while I might want to have the personal connection with everybody that I'm selling it to, I that's the first thing that I'm willing to relinquish right there.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you feel about the just development of the cheeses in the cellars? Are you happy with the maturation and I guess what's your relationship like? Do you go up there to check on the cheeses? Do they send you samples back down? How does that work?
That's sort of a relationship that's still in development.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not been a huge concern for us where only one of the cheeses that we send up there, do they finish maturing there? The rest are ready to sell when they arrive, and so it's just a matter for them of managing their inventory and, you know, as far as when they sell them. So they may hold them for, you know, a week to 3 weeks, but it's not nothing that I would consider a crucial, you know, change in the cheese. But with the wash-drying cheese, they do finish those. They get those when they're about 4 to 5 weeks old.
Okay.
And then they're sold, and they're about 65, 70 days old. At least that's when I sell mine.
And during that time, what kind of affinage work do they do? Just to give people an idea who haven't actually been in a cheese cellar, working with the cheese wheels.
Okay. Well, each piece of cheese is turned probably. I think with them it's just a couple of times a week because the conditions are such that it doesn't need as much handling as it does here because we have the mixed cellar and they have sort of specific cellars for the types of cheese, and then it's washed about once a week, I think, up there. And I think that's really all that they need to keep the bee linens developing on it and to keep the cheese in good shape. So when we finish that here, we wash that three times a week and cook it three times a week.
Wow.
It's a little bit more intensive, and it has to because of our conditions.
Yeah, definitely. The mold is competing with different molds that want to oust it. And now we at lunch also we enjoyed some cider that you had made that you're using to wash your cheeses. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it changes the flavor?
We use some hard cider that we make. I make it sort of. I do the easy part, and my friend Brad Keeler at Windfall Orchard, he does the hard part. He picks the apples and runs the press, and I just kind of feed the apples into the grinder and all that sort of stuff. So we make the hard cider and, wash it with that. It gets a little bit sweeter, a little bit fruitier sort of aroma. And this is the first year I've done it really consistently, and so I'm waiting to see if, you know, how I like the cheeses done with that. And I'd like to compare them, I think, with some that aren't done with that, so I'm probably going to get some from Jasper Hill and sort of do a little comparison on the cheeses.
Yeah, that's also, it's a nice way to sort of distinguish cheese that's coming, you know, straight from the farm, from cheese that's coming, you know, that's being matured elsewhere. Like you said, when I was at the farmer's market yesterday, there are certain things that you can only get at the farmer's market, which I think is pretty cool, you know.
We make a fair amount of cheese that way. Any cheese that I make that is more time or labor intensive, I tend to want to keep at the farmer's market. One is, it's economics. I get a better price for it there than I do anywhere else. And two, these are the people that I see every day, you know, for the most part. And so I like to have something special for them, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it seems like we're just about ready for another quick break. And then when we come back, I promise, we're going to talk to Michael about how the heck he got started making cheese and just sort of get a life or a day in the life of a cheesemaker at Twig Farm. So stick with us, and we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm Ann Saxelby. My guest is Michael Lee, a cheesemaker and owner of Twig Farms. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and our sponsor today is TechServe. So, Michael, we have to talk a little bit more about how you got started making cheese. I know this is a question that you've been asked like 5 million times. But, okay, so first of all, why cheese? Why not, you know, why not beer? Why not vegetables? Why not something else?
To get it as quickly as possible, I think that cheese probably, to me, it can incorporate a lot more culture and place as well, you know, in a really specific way. And I think that's what attracts me to cheese.
And you're not talking culture like bacteria.
No, I'm talking about the backgrounds of the people involved in producing and consuming it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that, and I love the way it tastes, or at least some of the way it tastes, the way it can taste. So it's got sort of the pleasurable hedonistic aspect to it, and then there's sort of an underpinning of something I can really think about while I'm doing it, and sort of some ideals that I can sort of explore.
Now, you had a background in art, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Before being a cheesemaker, what did you study? What was your
I painted, and I made some sculptures, but mostly I painted, I got that my degree in painting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I think, I don't know, I feel like a lot of artistic people are kind of drawn to cheese. I mean, I feel like there's some similarities. Do you feel that way at all?
I do. It can sound really fruity. If you get me in the right mood, I can go on and on about it. But there's something about creating this artifact. I think, and that's one of the things in general, is like, what happens if we do this to it? What happens if we do that to it? And at the end, you're left with something. You're left with, you know, the traces are something that you can consume in one way or another. In some ways, a lot of art making is the same thing. You know, it's like you take an idea and you do this to it, you do that to it, and you end up with, you know, a representation of that process.
Right, right. And it evolves and changes over time.
Yeah.
And would you say that season by season, you kind of go through different things like that with the different cheeses that you develop and make year to year, or even the cheeses that you've made since the beginning? Have those continued, in your opinion, to sort of evolve and change and get better and deeper roots?
And I guess this maybe reveals some of my aspects of how I thought about art making, but it's a lot of it's process oriented. And it's about practice, you know. And so every day, I think, you know, in all the years of making art, I might have had three or four ideas, you know, maybe one of them was good. And it's the same way with cheese making, you know. It's like you have a cheese that you have in mind, and all of the things that line up to make it, you know, how often do they happen? Yeah, so there's a lot of similarity in that way, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Now, actually, we have somebody special here in the studio, in quotation marks, with us. We're actually in Michael's living room, and his son, Carter, who is the biggest helper to the cheesemaker, is here. Carter, would you like to say something on the radio?
You want to tell everyone about the food?
Carter is... he is awesome. He's been helping us out all morning in the yard with the ducks. Can you tell us about the ducks, Carter? It's my friend on the radio. Do you want to tell him about the ducks?
Okay.
He said, no thanks. He's going to sit in and listen to us talk about cheese. Do you think, you know, do you have this is kind of a silly question, I guess, and has nothing to do with cheese, but who are some of your favorite artists?
I guess that no one's ever asked me that when I've been talking about cheese before.
I want to do some research.
maybe Robert Irwin?
I know, it's a tough question.
I haven't thought about it like that in a long time. They're kind of all over the place. Florine Stettheimer, Robert Irwin, Florine Stettheimer, Robert Ryman. Not Goldworthy, no. They're too close to home.
Yeah, that's true. He never made anything edible, though, so you've got a one-up on him there. But yeah, you know, I was thinking maybe the way you think about the pasture as well could be similar to Goldsworthy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking about more than anything. I was just like, yeah, you know, it's a very long term project, starting with one kind of landscape and what we're going to end up with. And I have some ideas, but it's kind of an interactive project with the goats.
Sure,
nature,
sure.
You know?
The biggest interactive sculpture ever attempted. The growth of the pasture at Twig Farm. But so, okay, well, so Twig Farm, that name comes from a story.
Yeah, it's just looking at what we were buying for land and what we were, you know, what we were going to be working with, and it was completely either overgrown pasture or woodlands. And so we were looking for a name that would apply to where we were, and also something about it that was particular. And well, we had a lot of twigs, and we knew that if we had, if we called it Twig Farm, that it's kind of silly, but we would be successful at being a twig farm. And we would always have twigs here, and sure enough, we do.
I love that story. And the goats, I mean, it's true. We went out for a little pasture walk earlier this afternoon, and I was amazed at the amount of different things that are out there for the goats that really, that sort of attention to not just, they do like eating brambly things per se, but not twigs though, right? Goats don't eat twigs.
They will.
They will?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's called woody browse in the nutritional literature. No one's exactly that and bark, and no one's exactly sure what it's all about, but they do it. they like it better if the leaves are attached to the twig.
Okay.
Then it's a complete food for them. Otherwise, they have to eat like a mouthful of grass or weed or something like that and the twig. And it's
kind of like when we're eating a salad. We have to have a little bit of the leaves and then some cheese like on top of the salad and make it, more pleasant.
Yeah.
I know we're almost out of time, but maybe can you just tell us really quickly a little bit about how you think about the goats and what they eat and how that influences the quality of the milk and, by turn, the cheese?
Oh, sure.
In
10 seconds.
Really, yeah, just really fast.
My approach as much as possible to sort of set some parameters and work within them. And so one of the parameters for the goats is when there's sufficient nutrition available out for them to forage themselves, they will, under any conditions, unless, it gets so wet or so, it's just murderously thunder and lightning, they're out there, and we continue to select for very hardy goats that can, they're not going to be coming back to the barn except for milking between April and October. That's just, that's not an option for them. And so that's, the first step is that having the pastures that provide a variety of foods, and from woody browse, leafy browse, grassy pastures, weedy pastures, just a really wide variety of options depending on the weather and the time of year. And that plays into what the goats want. It plays into the milk that they make. The flavors will change depending on not just what they're eating, but what time of year they're eating it and what stage of maturation the plants are at and stuff like that. And so it's kind of, looking at things the opposite of making a consistent cheese as far as flavor is concerned. It's more of a spectrum of flavors depending on when it's made. So we try to make, and that's another thing that we try to keep it within parameters of, moisture and that sort of thing as far as the cheese is concerned. But sometimes you have a little difficulty. But it should be recognizably the same cheese, but it should not be the same cheese if it's made in May or if it's made in October. And I think that's as it should be. Does that answer the question?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's the tip of the iceberg, but maybe we can get you to come back at some point, or maybe, we can come back up to Vermont and do a part two in the fall and see how the pasture is different.
Yeah,
but I think, that old adage, you are what you eat, is like, true times 20 for the goats.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It had better be, or else there's no point in doing it the way I'm doing it. I guess it's a gamble that I'm making, that it does make a difference.
Yeah, well, so far, all signs point to delicious, so I think it's been working out pretty well. But all right, well, I think, unfortunately, we are out of time for today. But join us a week from Sunday on the next episode of Cutting the Curd, which is actually going to be broadcast. Oh, no, we'll be back in New York then. We'll be back in the studio. Come the end of August, we're going to be back in Vermont for a Cheesemakers Festival, which Michael will be at. So maybe we can snag you for a minute there.
Oh, maybe.
But thank you so much for being on the show and for making delicious cheese. And we'll see you next time on Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.